Thanks, Vivian. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Enjoy the show.
Thanks, Dermot. Thank you very much. Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon. 51551 ray at rte.ie. We have three people in today that you may want to ask questions of. I'm sure of this. Conor Pope is back. I know his day is usually Monday, but Revolut have sent emails out to their nearly 2 million Irish customers to say that they will have an Irish IBAN, which is a big thing. And we're going to ask Conor Pope, what does it mean to us Revolut customers? And you might have questions for him about that too. Samantha Rawson is back, our dog expert. And today we're sort of homing in, concentrating on nervous dogs. But indeed, if you have any questions about your dog, but we're looking for particularly ones about nervousness. You know, if you're off to work and you're leaving the dog at home, if you're bringing it to a dog minder, if it's nervous around cars or other people or other animals or whatever, if you have a question for Samantha Rawson, our dog expert, ray@rte.ie. And we have Professor Janice Walsh, who's an oncologist, ahead of February the 4th, which is not too far away, which is World Cancer Day. And we'll be speaking about the links between alcohol consumption and cancer and other things as well. So if you have any questions about that, get them into us, ray@rte.ie. So there are the three people we'll be talking to today that you may have questions for. So that's that out of the way. There's sort of loads of follow-on from the 14 Oscar nominations. And I don't think we're overstating it when we say it's a historic day. It was a historic day. It's brilliant. It's sort of lifted the spirits of the country, a la Italia 90 and other things. Sonia Sullivan winning the silver medal in the Sydney Olympics. That all those, they just lift the spirit of a nation, don't they? And they make you proud to be Irish. And I see here that yesterday was a good day for students out Kildare way. Karen Mulreid tweeted, said, "Great day for Ireland with all the Oscar nominations. Incredible achievements all round. Great day for me too. Paul Mescal's dad," that's Paul Mescal Sr., "is my son's teacher. And he let them off homework tonight as a celebration. As a parent, no homework is better than an Oscar," to be fair. And of course, Paul Mescal, not a surprise really, but he was the dark horse when it came to the nominations for Best Actor. And the Off Menu podcast, which is put together by James Acaster and Ed Gamble, who are two UK comedians, have started their third or fourth season. And their first guest happens to be Paul Mescal. They landed on their feet. And they sit people down and they ask them about their menu. So it's a food type podcast with a lot of laughs. And they're asking Paul about his favourite meal. And of course, he refers back to his mammy's cooking. And we had Mammy Dervla on yesterday. We had a lovely chat with her. So proud, so emotional. And we only heard afterwards about the other thing that was going on in her life. And we wish her well and send her out virtual hugs. But this is her son, who she's very proud of, talking about her broccoli soup. Yes.
She makes this broccoli potato onion soup, which I know doesn't sound particularly, but it's just, to me, I would eat buckets of it.
Great.
I would literally go through it for a shortcut. And it's like one of the things that I anticipate most about Christmas.
Yeah.
Is this soup. It's like salty, hearty. And then like I'd have more bread. I'd have O'Donnell's brown bread with Kerrygold butter. And just be... I probably wouldn't even use a spoon. It would just be like spooning it off with the bread.
With the bread, yeah.
Yeah, there's double cream. There's potato, broccoli, and onions. And there's probably some other stuff in there.
A stock of some sort, maybe?
A stock, a vegetable stock, I think. Yeah. But it's just pretty, like it's a thick, hard, it's like not, it's not a gentle soup.
And we've all done that. You lash on the butter onto the bread and then you dip the bread into the soup and whoa. I don't know what's going on scientifically, but the combination of the warm, salty, soupy thing and the butter and the bread, and it's just momentary. It's brilliant, because if you leave it too long, it gets soggy and not nice. But if you do it right and do it quick, so broccoli soup there, a big hit with Paul Mescal. And Colleen Kuhn, of course, yesterday, that was a big story as well. And I've been saying to a lot of people that it should be shown in all secondary schools in the country, because it would do a huge amount to promote our language in a real way. And now that it's nominated for an Oscar, better still. And if you haven't seen it, well, where have you been? But there's a great opportunity for schools to bring the class to see it at the Dríocht Theatre in Blanchardstown on Wednesday the 15th of March. They must have been listening to us. Wouldn't it be great for a class trip? They're doing two screenings that day. I'm sure there will be other screenings across the country. The Dríocht are offering tickets at €5 per student and teachers go free. And I know a lot of teachers listen to us on the way home from work. So if you're an Irish teacher in a secondary school and you can get to the Dríocht Theatre in Blanchardstown on the 15th of March, that might be a thing to do, something to put in to your diary, dríocht.ie. Loads of smart Alex as well, which is great. A lot of fun around the Oscars. Sharon Mannion was tweeting, I have two Oscar tickets, Hogan stand upper tier. I'm looking to swap for two Cusack stands. That's great. Yeah, and Steven Spielberg, not Irish, but The Fabelmans is up for, I think, 7 nominations. And they're telling us today about the long relationship between Steven Spielberg and John Williams, who has done the scores for a lot of the Steven Spielberg movies. They've been known each other for, I think, and working together for 50 years now, which is remarkable, isn't it? And I'm going to play some of John Williams' scores, and they're just immediately recognisable. But first to tell you that he's been nominated, this nomination, he's 90, is his 53rd Oscar nomination for original scores and original songs. I think the majority of them, 48 or thereabouts, are for scores, and then there's 4 or 5 for original songs. He's won 5 Oscars, and 3 of those for Steven Spielberg movies. So as I say, immediately recognisable, and we're just doing the Steven Spielberg ones now here. Close Encounters of a Third Kind, staying with the extraterrestrials. It lifts the spirit. You're on that chopper bike, taking off, aren't you? With a little extraterrestrial in your basket. And if you're going to take on the world and looking for a lost antique of some description. Here's your soundtrack. Yes, here's your score. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Right, now you got the idea. See if we can identify this Steven Spielberg produced movie. Yeah. You got it, yeah. Jurassic Park, that film there. While we're on dangerous non-human species. '75, Jaws, and that won John Williams an Oscar for original score. E.T. won an Oscar for him as well, and this one won an Oscar in 1993. Said this before and I'll say it again, the combination of the right pictures and the right music together can evoke any sort of emotion, and Steven Spielberg and John Williams together, they know how to do it, lads. They've been doing it for 50 years. Are you ever sitting at the traffic lights and you see a vista in front of you, whatever it might be? It could be at night, it could be during the day, there could be somebody passing by on a bike, you might spot a child playing over, and then you have the soundtrack playing in your head. Do you ever do that, a song or a piece of music? No, maybe it's just me. Okay, 5155 on radar at rte.ie. Good afternoon. Carol King, a song co-written with James Taylor from her Tapestry album from 1971. Still sounds good. Still a great pop song. Now, 5 on 5 on radarte.ie. We're looking for two of you to come on after 4 o'clock and take part in our Who Done a Quiz? Our what? Our Who Done a Quiz? Yeah, it's our newish quiz. We're looking for two of you to answer three whodunit questions on music, sport, books, politics, comedy, inventions, loads more. Anything that involves human endeavour is up for grabs. Like all whodunits, there will be clues. If you answer without a clue, you get two. However, if you take the easier option and go for a clue, you get 1 point. And there is a prize. And this week we say thank you very much to the people in the iconic K Club in County Kildare. A two-night stay. A culinary escape, they're calling it. So you'll enjoy a hearty breakfast in the elegant, sumptuous surroundings of the Barton. Later on, you'll meander across the resort's winding greens to the clubhouse for fabulous food in the Palmer. Then the following day, you can have a lively brunch surrounded by a buzzing atmosphere and touch of mischief in the New South Barton restaurant. 7 different food and drink spaces in one place. The K Club's guests are guaranteed superb taste and flavour sensations, thoughtful attention to detail, produce-led dishes and drinks of distinction. kclub.ie, kclub.ie. Now, here's your qualifying question today. How many Oscar nominations did the Irish secure yesterday? 14 or 1400? How many Oscar nominations did the Irish secure yesterday? 14 or 1400? 0818 715925. That's 0818 715925.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, or 5 on 5 5 1. What movie was that last score from? Sorry, did I not say it? Schindler's List. That was Schindler's List there. John Williams again, and directed by Steven Spielberg. Plaintive, I suppose, is how you describe that. Did John Williams do Glen Rowe? No, he didn't. James, for texting in, because you've made me feel less odd. I would have music playing in my head during any activity. And on a holiday, I would have a theme tune suitable for the country or area. That's James in Limerick. And Betty's been on in the Yorkshire Dales with my sister last year. As we drove up and down the hill country, I played All Creatures Great and Small, the Sig tune. It was funny. It was good. I think this is it. It sets the mood. It sets the mood, doesn't it? Yeah, imagine if each area had its own soundtrack. Anyway, if you're a Revolut customer, and there are 1.9 million Revolut customers in Ireland, then you might have gotten an email in the last couple of days about an Irish IBAN. So what does this mean, and will it affect the way banking works? Conor Pope has been looking into this, and he joins us on the line of a Wednesday. Good afternoon, Conor.
Hi, Ray. How are you getting on?
Not too bad. Do you have a soundtrack in your head?
I was just thinking that, and, no.
No, okay. That's fair enough. You don't have to.
I'm not going to criticise you for it. That's what floats your boat, Ray. Knock yourself out.
Right. So just give us a history of Revolut in Ireland first, and then we'll talk about the IBANs. Yeah.
Well, I suppose the remarkable thing is they've only been in Ireland since 2015. So this fintech set up in 2015, and it came into the Irish market almost immediately. And Irish people took to it, particularly a younger cohort, because effectively what it did was it offered people an alternative to a bank. It didn't have the full range of services that a bank offered, at least in the early days. But the really important thing I think that it did was it allowed people transfer money from one person to another person in real time. And that's why to revolute money, and it became a verb. So you don't just send somebody money, say, I'll revolute that to you. And any time a technology becomes a verb, like to Google something or to Hoover your carpet or whatever it might be, you know, you get a sense that something is happening there that's out of the ordinary. So it happened extremely quickly, and as you say, it has around 2 million customers in Ireland, which is almost 10% of its global customer base. And I think one of the reasons for that is because it offered something different, and it offered something that Irish banks at the time weren't offering. In many respects, it offered something that Irish banks still aren't offering. And it was attractive to people, because one of the things that bugs me is, like, when you're transferring money from an AIB account to a Bank of Ireland account or a PTSB account or whatever it might be, like, the money just disappears into the ether.
It's like, for a few days,
And especially if you transfer it on a Friday evening at 5 o'clock.
You can't be doing
Monday.
That.
I was like, lads, it's computers. They don't have a weekend. Why do I have to wait until the next business day? That makes no sense to me. And I've tried to find out why that is from banks, and I've never had a satisfactory answer. And I think the interesting thing about Revolut, it said, well, there's no reason for that. It's a computer, and computers don't rest. And if I transfer money from me to you, using Revolut or indeed N26 or Bunk or one of the other fintechs, because they're not the only player in the market, well, then, you know, it goes instantly. And the other thing is, to transfer money, you just need a phone and a phone number. And as opposed to, what's your BIC and your IBAN and blah, 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 blah. So it was easier. And I think that's why all of these fintechs have gone some way to eating a huge chunk of the traditional bank's lunch in recent times.
So fintech is short for financial technology. Fintech, yes. How, I don't know if you know this, but how do the traditional banks view Revolut and their ilk?
Well, they should view them with deep suspicion, if not fear, because, you know, the traditional banks have been slow to move into the space. Now,
why?
Having said that,
why do you think?
Well, for a start, I think a lot of banks here, you know, they understand the customers are very slow to switch. Very, very slow rates of switching banks, current accounts in this country. So they might have been caught off guard a little bit. So that's one key thing. Another point that's worth remembering is that, you know, they are getting better. So the online platforms and the apps that the various banks have are getting better. And one of the things that's coming down the tracks very soon is a kind of a collaboration between Permanent TSB, Bank of Ireland, AIB and others, which is going to be called Sync. And basically it will allow the Irish banks to do that real-time transfer that Revolut already does. And I think that'll be a bit of a game changer, and it'll allow the Irish banks claw back maybe some of the business that they've lost to Revolut.
Okay, so Sync. When is that imminent? We haven't got back. We'll get back to the IBAN in a moment.
Yeah, it's been in the pipeline for 3 years. It was, it had to be given approval by the CCPC and the central bank and all of that stuff. Because, like, in fairness to the banks, they're legacy banks, so they have different terms and conditions, and they have to work at a different rate than a startup. They don't have the same kind of dynamism that startups have.
Okay. Now, the IBAN. So up until now, Revolut had what sort of an IBAN? Or just explain IBANs to us first.
Okay, well, it's a unique identifier that basically marks out a bank and an account as a unique thing. And Revolut were regulated in another part of the country, in another part of Europe. So they were offering Lithuanian IBANs to Irish people. Now, they did have an Irish banking license as of last year. And that Irish banking license meant that they had the bank guarantee, so that your money was protected up to 100,000 euros and all that stuff. But what they didn't have was an Irish IBAN. And that means that a lot of the time when people went to their employer and said, listen, can I have my money paid into my bank account? There were problems because the machine said, well, hang on a second, that's not an Irish account, that's a Lithuanian account. Or when you tried to set up a direct debit to pay for a service, whatever the service might be, there were people experiencing problems because, again, they were trying to set it up with a Lithuanian bank account as opposed to an Irish bank account. Yeah. So that's why this IBAN matters, because now the computers that we've talked about already will identify the Revolut bank accounts as Irish, so there can be no impediment to having your money lodged into your account, your wages, or there can be no impediment to you setting up direct debits. Now, there shouldn't have been an impediment anyway, because the whole notion of the Single European Payments Area, or SEPA, was that all of Europe, all of the EU, Eurozone countries were treated equally. But that just wasn't the case in reality for a lot of people. But that's an obstacle that was in the way. Now, they're not the first of this fintech companies. Bunk, last year, got itself an Irish IBAN. So they're not the first to do it, but they are the biggest player in the market to do it.
I think you have a soundtrack going on in your head now. It's spilling. Do you know what?
I'm in the convention centre, and I went into a room that was really quiet, and slowly they started turning up the music. So I've just gone out into the hallway, and there's a whole bunch of people out in the hallway. So we might just have to deal with the soundtrack.
Okay, I'm joking. Yeah. So are there any downsides of this? Because I suppose I considered Revolut to be a lean, mean, fast machine. Not encumbered by IBANs and all that sort of thing. When you went to, as you've outlined already, you just need a number and you send it on and it's immediate. So introducing IBANs, is that going to slow the process down?
It's not going to make any difference to you transferring money to me, Ray. So if you want to do that now, that's fine. I'll take the cash. Okay. But so it's not going to make any material difference in that sense. But having said that, it's worth pointing out that the legacy banks do have advantages over the fintechs, over these startup tech companies, because they have a footprint in our communities and they have a place in our society. Now, a lot of the time they've given up that place and they've said, oh, listen, we don't want branches and we don't want human interactions and we want it all to be done online. I think the Irish banks would be well advised to exploit the advantages that they do have, because one of the problems that people have had with the likes of Revolut is that if something goes wrong, it can be very difficult to find a human being to talk to make it go right. Not impossible, but very difficult. Whereas at least with a real bank, and I use the word real like I'm some kind of boomer, but at least with an actual bank, you know, there is a hope sometimes that if something goes wrong, you can get redress. Although, in my experience and in the experience of our listeners, that often isn't the case either.
So is this another step on Revolut's journey to becoming a traditional bank giving loans and mortgages, etc.?
Absolutely. Well, what will happen now is if more people are having money lodged into their accounts from their employers, the balance sheet of Revolut changes and it has more money on deposit. And if it has more money on deposit, well, then it'll start entering the game where it's going to be able to offer personal loans or indeed mortgages. And for a bank, that's where the real money is. That's where the profits are to be made. And that's why banks are very keen to lend money out to people, because they make more money doing that than they do by offering the various things that the current account offers. Yeah. So it's not going to happen today or tomorrow, but ultimately that would be the end game of Revolut and these other fintech banks, because that's where the money is to be made and that's what they will ultimately want to do. And the speed at which they're moving would lead me to suggest that it's all going to happen very quickly.
And the more competition there is, the better for us customers, although, you know, we're seeing now and we're hearing it every day, Brian Hayes is on loop on the radio. KBC and Ulster Bank are leaving and people have been encouraged to move their accounts, all that sort of thing. But so is Irish a bad place to be a bank?
Well, it was a bad place because of the great unpleasantness of 2008 and 2009. And that means that Irish banks had to have more money on deposit to protect the state and to protect the banks from crashes that might have happened in the future. So, you know, Irish banks were definitely under pressure. Ulster Bank was under huge pressure because it had suffered in the banking crash. KBC had to figured they could make more money elsewhere. But all of these new tech startups and the fintechs, they won't be encumbered by the same legacy pressures that the traditional banks were under. So they will probably be able to, as you say, they'll be leaner and they'll be able to make more money. And that's ultimately the game they're in.
Can you ask Conor Pope if my associated Revolut UK SOR code - account number will change when I'm transferred to Irish IBAN?
It might, but you're going to be getting an email. Anyone who's with Revolut will be getting an email outlining exactly what they can expect to happen. So I would advise anybody who gets that email, and there'll be 1.9 million people who'll be getting that email, to read that mail closely and not just go, oh, I'll just put that into my junk, or I'm just going to ignore that because that's just no more terms and conditions. It's important to read and understand what's happening with that account, because it will matter in the future.
Paddy in Crossmont Glen says, we really found Revolut handy in South Armagh. We are a dual currency here and we also shop both sides of the border. We could have a euro and a sterling account on the one card. That's Paddy in Crossmont Glen.
Absolutely. And that's actually a big advantage because it does allow that whole foreign exchange thing happen. And there's other advantages. It's not just, I mean, your listeners might be left thinking that it's just about the ease of transferring money. I mean, there's lots of other ways. It allows you to set up junior Revolut accounts. Yeah. So my kids, for instance, have access to a junior Revolut account, which means that I can give them money via Revolut. And also, I know where they're spending it. Yeah. So I can see $2.99 in Starbucks. So, you know, I can track them that way. And also it allows you to, you know, buy shares and invest in cryptocurrencies. If you're going to be crazy enough to invest in cryptocurrencies, this makes it easier for you to do it. I'm not suggesting your listeners do that, because that seems to me like a mug's game.
Yeah, the reason Revolut is so loved is because so much more than a counter card. You get so much more travel insurance, purchase insurance, cash back on sales. It's fantastic. I gave my wife the gift of a Revolut account. She was in London recently and used her card for everything. Roll, baby, roll. So, Shane.
Roll, baby, roll.
Now, Conor, before you go, will you get your man to give us a tune there?
Do you know, I've just realised he's singing Zombie.
Is he? Right?
The weirdest version of Zombie I've ever heard in my life. I don't know what's going on, but I'm sorry now that your listeners had to hear that.
No, but thanks so much for that. The history of Revolut, the implications of their new Irish Eye Band and everything else. Thanks, Conor. Mind yourself.
Thanks a lot, Ray. Mind yourself. Take care. Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the 4th of February, as I said, is World Cancer Day, which is an international day of raising awareness about cancer and to encourage its prevention, detection and treatment. Today, we are joined in studio by oncologist Professor Janice Walsh. We're going to chat about the links between alcohol and cancer and about the risks that many people out there simply aren't aware of. And I've no doubt that people may be upset by our chat, because it's things they're ignorant of, unaware of, and they sort of continue doing what they're doing in sort of ignorance. Janice, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ray.
And people will be upset, won't they, when they hear the facts?
Well, they tend to be. You know, I suppose as an oncologist, you know, every day I meet people who are inflicted by cancer. And the big thing that always hits me is that while I'm talking about the fact that they'll need to go through chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, biological therapy and all the new things coming out, really what they want to know is what they can do to modify their risk. And, you know, it's pretty simple that despite all of this marketing towards multiple nutrients and supplements, etc., really it boils down to three important factors. One, keeping our weight in check. Two, exercising. So that works out at about 30-minute brisk walk every day. And number three, keeping alcohol as low as possible. And it's bad. January is bad enough. So us sitting down here talking about the association between alcohol and cancer, you know, upsets people because it's something that they associate with enjoyment, letting their shoulders come down after a long day at work. But unfortunately, it's pretty clear from consistent data that's been emerging is that there is a very significant risk between our association between alcohol and the amount of it that we take and our risk of cancer development.
You say emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why some people may not know about it, because it didn't exist in the past, this knowledge that we have now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a body of evidence that has been accumulating over time, but it's pretty consistent at this point. It's very hard to find a guideline that doesn't say that there is a significant risk between the amount of alcohol you take and your cancer risk. So it's hard to avoid. It's undeniable. And right now, you know, if we are diagnosed with cancer, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which is a body that creates very important guidelines, will tell us that that is a modifiable risk factor that is associated with cancer development and should be avoided as best we can. And I think what's interesting is that same data is coming out in terms of prevention. So preventing sitting in front of somebody like me, we need to do those same things. And I think what's being challenged at the moment is the guidelines with regard to alcohol intake. So in the past, we've talked about 12 units or less for women, 17 units or less for males. But now there is emerging data to suggest that maybe even going over one drink a day or even drinking more than three drinks a week may increase our risk. So I suppose it's just about re-examining the relationship we have with alcohol and asking, why do we drink?
Why don't people know this? Like, everybody makes an association between smoking and cancer.
Yes. I mean, I think in the main, people know it's not good for us, but it's something that people enjoy. I suppose the thing that I find is interesting for me is people have such little understanding of what a unit is and what's harmful. So I suppose the bit that I love to get out there when I'm meeting people on a regular basis, trying to educate them about what they would see as, you know, really turning the table on themselves, talking about, look, alcohol intake and what they think of that. And the shock related to the fact that, you know, when they talk about maybe coming home in the evening and maybe having a half a bottle of wine, when they hear that that's five units as opposed to, because it fits in a glass, one and a half, they're truly shocked by that. So I think it's just, you know, we have an obligation, all of us who are in healthcare and, of course, the people who create policy, to educate people about what is a unit and, you know, how it lies. So what's in a pint of beer.
So if you have the information, then you can make an informed choice.
Correct.
Now, I was looking at some statistics and something like only 25%, that's about a quarter of people, know there is a link between alcohol and cancer. That means that 75% of us are walking around and drinking, not knowing that we're doing harm and could be causing, not causing, but increasing our risk of getting cancer.
I think that's true. I mean, that would tally with what we see in the clinics and people who are inflicted with it. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think, you know, where do we go with this?
Yes, yeah.
It's very important that we're starting to educate our children. So no more so than we bring in sex education at an earlier age, we need to be bringing in what's involved with alcohol, why it's not good for us, you know, what way we should be approaching it, and managing the peer pressure associated with the importance of, you know, social integration means having a drink when you're 14, 15, 16, and that it's okay.
And do people ask you questions like, what is the risk? What is the increase in risk?
Yeah. So I suppose what they look for really is guidance in terms of what is acceptable. And I suppose, as we've said, it's kind of changing. So right now, I deal with breast cancer. So 95% of my clinical workload are people who have had a breast cancer history. And right now we know that going over one drink per day increases your risk. And if you are taking between 3 and 6 per day, your risk is twofold higher. So people find that hard to understand. But the reality is that we have 5 and 10% increased risk of disease recurrence happening, you know, according to the number of increase in drinks we're taking. So it's just exponentially increasing on an ongoing basis. So it's really important that what I try and educate them is that any habitual drinking, we try and eradicate. So certainly it's okay to have 1 or 2 glasses at the weekend to relax if that's important to us. But certainly any routine stuff that we associate during the week, I try and tell them, please try and not do that.
Because you say it's okay for the couple of drinks at the weekend, and the WHO, the World Health Organization, has come out and said there's no safe level of alcohol intake.
Correct. So, and that is the reality. But I suppose in the setting where you're dealing with people who may sometimes be having 30 units of alcohol a week and thinking there was nothing abnormal with that, you know, we have to try and encourage to say, yes, there's no data to suggest there's a safe level after you've had a cancer diagnosis, but you need to bring down your level. So that tends to be gentle, you know, giving information, but you need to do encouragement. I think the other thing that's important, and it is important for people who'll be listening, you know, in the past where I've talked about this, people have been, you know, offended by the fact that they've had a breast cancer diagnosis. Their friends have been listening to things like this and they're worried that that person thinks that they're having a huge amount of alcohol and that they've caused this cancer themselves. Cancer development is multifactorial. I suppose the issue that we're trying to deal with at the moment is what you can do to modify your risk.
So this is a controllable risk.
Correct.
You have control over it. You can decide to do something, change your behaviour.
Absolutely right. And it is, from the data that's coming out, estimated that if we took alcohol out totally, we would have 5% less cancers. I mean, that's pretty stark.
Yes.
And that's in
not
Europe.
Happen.
Well, it doesn't look like it.
No.
And countries where they have a very strong relationship with, you know, wine intake, they have higher levels that are probably associated with.
So 80% of us drink
alcohol use.
80% of us drink. Mm-hmm. And we've talked on this show and other people have talked about our relationship as a nation with alcohol. It's unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. Whose responsibility is it to get this information out there? And what has happened to labelling on wine bottles and beer bottles?
Well, right now, the only thing that they have to put on the wine bottles is the percentage of alcohol. And that's what you see. You know, if you've got a bottle of wine, it's 13.5%, 12.5%, etc. There's definitely a big debate at the moment in terms of whether there should be labelling on the bottles. And some European countries do it. In Ireland, as you know, we don't. I think it's important. I think it's important for a number of reasons. One, when you read it, we know that it has an impact. And number two, from an education point of view, just really that I think that people would stand back if they thought that on the bottle of their bottle of wine at the end, that it would say this contains 9 to 10 units of alcohol. And We know that from previous studies, labelling has so-so of an effect in terms of perception, because this is, again, is something that's associated with relaxation, enjoyment. But I think personally, I see no more so than we label our smoking packets, our cigarette packets, that labelling on alcohol in terms of education is important. So I think there's a number of people that are responsible. I think at a government level, obviously, that would be important. The industry needs to engage, because this is something that is reproducible. It's not something in our minds. Alcohol has an impact. And I think it needs to be brought into our education system. Yeah. Because you know what? We all grow sense, of course, in our mid-30s and 40s. And then we start thinking about it. We've babies keeping us awake at night. We can't drink like we did before. But it's really important that from a young age, we're understanding, you know, the impact of this kind of intervention. So that, like everything, it becomes part of habit not to do it so much.
Yeah, like the alcohol industry aren't going to volunteer to put labels on their products saying that it causes cancer or is linked with a higher risk of cancer. That's not going to happen.
So it has to be government
policy. It has to be mandatory, doesn't
Correct.
It?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So it has to, it's ultimately the buck stops with the government.
100%.
And of course, there are lots of vested interests.
There
who,
are.
Who will lobby the government to make sure that that doesn't happen.
There are.
Yeah.
But I still believe that it's achievable. You know, we would have said the same thing with regard to cigarette packets, and there it lies. So I think it's important, and I think it should be part of policy.
Have you thought about the difference between cigarette smoking and consuming alcohol? Because people make, you know, the comparisons, and they go back in the day, you know, over 50% of us smoked, and we did that until we knew that there was a direct link between smoking and lung cancer. And then the information, we gathered the information, we made informed choices, and a lot of us decided to never smoke or stop smoking.
Yes.
Okay, so that's that story.
Yes.
And it's has twists and turns, and there's vaping and all that sort of thing. But we're getting there. So alcohol.
I think it could be the same story. I think that if we start educating people to the harms of it, that we should have a reduction in the intake of alcohol. I think it could have exactly the same story if people were behind it, people who mattered.
Mm. Just to go back to some of the definitions. So it's a class one carcinogen.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so we know that there's a high level of evidence to suggest that it damages our normal cells. So in alcoholic drinks, the piece that's important is the ethanol. And basically that's metabolized into acetaldehyde within our body. And that in itself is a carcinogen, which interferes with the normal DNA of our cells. So, i.e. all the things that protect our cells from harm, it overcomes those. And we know in addition to that, that it impairs our ability to be able to absorb certain nutrients, vitamins that are important for us. And number three, it increases our serum estrogen levels. So for women, that's important because it's a promoter of cancer growth in the setting of breast cancer.
So it affects our hormones, does it?
Correct.
How? What happens?
So it just causes a increase in
estrogen.
Serum estrogen, yeah. Yeah.
Wow, it wreaks havoc, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And there's a very, you know, solid association with alcohol and breast cancer development. Much stronger, it has to be said, in the setting of head and neck cancer, esophageal cancer, liver cancer, but strong for both colon cancer and for breast cancer.
Right. Let's see if there's anybody who wants to talk about this today. What about the people in Europe who have a glass of wine every day?
Oh. I know. I'm always amazed how much people hang on to that one. Right now, I can say reproducibly, the harms of alcohol are far greater than any possible benefits.
Yeah, because it is risks and benefit, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. And the previous benefit was this question of whether a glass of red wine, which carries something called resveratrol, which is in the grape of
is
the
it an
skin
antioxidant?
Of the... Correct.
Oh, yes.
Red grapes.
Yes,
we love
yes,
the
yes,
antioxidants. Yeah. That it has a better improvement on your cardiovascular health, right. So your circulation. But really, at this point, that is not borne out very strong. So... Yeah. Right now, don't
Where
do
is
it.
That information coming from?
Well, there's studies coming out all of the
right.
time,
right.
right? I mean, we're always looking for associations with cancer, what can make us do better, what makes us do worse. I mean, we see studies every day indicating risks with maybe a drug that you take for some other condition that may be linked to causing harm in something else. These are associations that are constantly being, you know, discredited and proven.
Liz says, so lovely to hear my oncologist on your show. She's a rock of sense, very open-minded, honest and reassuring to all her patients. That's Liz in Bray. How does the doctor explain how does one get breast cancer and they never had one drink in their 74 years?
Very good point. And you're absolutely right. And I think this is important because up back to that thing, you know, it's not just alcohol that is a problem. Obviously, we know that the development of any cancer is multifactorial. We know it is a disease of increasing age, which is always surprising to patients, particularly, you know, if you ask the medical students, what's the median age for breast cancer development? They all think it's 40, but it's not. It's in the late 50s and early 60s. So as we get older, obviously, our normal defences within ourselves can become defective. And there's a range of different things that have an impact on that. It's probably part genetic and part environmental. So you're absolutely right, listener. It is not just alcohol alone, for sure.
Yeah, and use multifactorial.
Yes, there's, multifactorial. Yeah, yeah.
I'm a stage 4 cancer patient that had a very low alcohol intake, so please give other side of coin. You will get cancer despite drinking. Yes.
And that is 100% true, and I hope I've made that clear today.
Yeah. And what about hereditary breast cancer? My mother and grandmother died of breast cancer and neither of them drank alcohol. Yeah, well, you know, yeah. So and they're valid arguments.
Very.
But it doesn't get away from the facts.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's back to the fact of what can I do to keep myself well? And it is a clear modifiable factor that is associated with cancer development. As all of your listeners have said, this is not the only one, but it is an important one. And it's one that we need to take note of. And we need to help people understand what's healthy for them and in what way they can reduce their intake.
Now, Professor Janice Walsh, you're a lovely woman, a caring woman, big heart, obviously do a great job, and you're a lone voice. We don't hear many, you know, we don't hear many people on the radio saying what you're saying, right? And then you have the might of the alcohol industry.
Yes.
You know, who've coined phrases like wine o'clock and I'm worth it and all of those things. Do you ever get sort of a little bit frustrated? Because do you ever even think that you're up against the alcohol industry in any way, shape or form?
I mean, I know I'm up against the alcohol industry for sure. I suppose you're absolutely right. I'm not a lone voice because as oncologists, we're talking about this day in, day out. The difficulty is there's only about 50 of us in the country. And as doctors, I'm not sure we're the best for regularly being on talking about this. We tend to graft away in our clinics and talk to the people that listen to us. But I think it is an important message to get out. And I suppose, which is why I would have taken your invitation to come speak today, Ray, because I feel passionate about this.
It's been a bugbear to me for a long time now. As a drinker and from an alcoholic family, I get the dangers of drinking and overdrinking, but it's the terminology from the drinks industry and the health sector just adds to the problem. I don't drink units, I drink glasses. And if I'm being honest, bottles of wine, pints of beer and glasses of spirits. I've no real idea of the coalition between a glass of wine and a unit of alcohol. It's good to hear your expert explain in normal parlance what a unit is. Thanks. That's Brian. And in different countries, there are different units and yeah.
Well, it depends about your alcohol, the alcohol content.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, in general, I always say to people, keep it simple. You know, a pint of beer is just under 3 units. A bottle of Bud is about 1.5 units.
Okay.
A unit of gin, which is 25 mils, which is your pour from the pub, is 1 unit. And a bottle of wine is between 8 and 10, depending on your alcohol intake.
And you see, there's the problem as well. For example, if you were doing labelling on bottles, that a lot of the alcohol consumed is not consumed from a bottle. It's consumed in a pub from a glass.
Yes. But if glass is, you know, I mean, we can work that out, right? In terms of a pint comes out in a pint glass, that's just under 3 units.
Yeah, but you see, but people don't know that.
I know. I hear you.
Saying,
yes.
You know,
it's not labelled on
exactly,
the pint glass.
Exactly.
Yes,
people
sure.
assume that a pint is a unit.
Yes.
I would say a lot of people listening now think that a pint is a unit.
There's absolutely no question that that's what people think.
Yeah.
You're absolutely 100%
right. And what's
the
limit? What's the limit? And it's not a target. The limit for men now, for example.
Well, right
Ireland.
Now, one of the guidelines would suggest 17 units and under for males.
So imagine
and not in one go.
Right.
So not going to the pub and having 6 pints.
Yeah. But imagine
that is a definition of binge drinking,
yes,
which in itself is more harmful.
More harmful. But imagine if you think that a unit is a pint, then you think you can have 17 pints.
And
which
have you
in
seen
fact,
the size of some of those wine glasses?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 51 units.
That's 1 unit, according to the person drinking.
Yes, yeah.
But you're
yeah.
absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah, so 17 pints is 51 units of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It is crazy. It is. So Have you any ideas? Are there any campaigns coming down the tracks, or it'll just be the next time that you're on the radio that people will
Well, I'm happy
this?
To be involved in any campaign that wants to talk about it, for yeah. sure. I think it's absolutely imperative that we have this into the school curriculum. We need to be talking to these kids that go into first year about the dangers of alcohol, because in some certain circles, it's becoming even more acceptable from a parent point of view to be making sure these kids are not left out having some alcohol at 15 and 16 years of age. So I think we need to support these children, and I think we need to educate them on the dangers yes. of alcohol. And there's emerging data also showing that for our young girls, late teens, early 20s, that increased levels of alcohol intake will again has a direct correlation with greater risk of breast cancer development later on. So it's real. And we're seeing in the breast cancer world a 2-4% increase in breast cancer cases every year. So we are having over 3,200 in Ireland a year at the moment. And on the basis of what we're seeing and the worrying alcohol trends in our teenagers, this increase is not going to slow down anytime soon.
Okay. We will talk again, I'm sure, Professor Janice Walsh, oncologist. Thanks so much. And more information at cancer.ie. Thanks, Janice.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, I appreciate the message greatly, but at the moment I feel like we can't do anything. We don't smoke, don't drink, don't look at the phone, don't eat meat. Everything in moderation, but Jesus, says that person. It's a difficult message, and I said that at the outset, and nobody wants to hear it. Would you prefer not to know or to know? Well, I suppose people are shouting at the radio. I prefer not to know, Ray. Ignorance is bliss. Isn't that what they say? There's a growing movement of sober, curious people in this country who are choosing to put our health first. The reason people don't talk about it is in Ireland there is an assumption that if you don't drink, you're either pregnant, on antibiotics, driving or a raving alcoholic. It's difficult for people to accept that you're just making an informed choice to put your health first. Then I said that recently, that I passed by an ad for one of those zero alcohol beers, and it said zero need for explanation. So they've done their research, they have a lot of money, they know that one of the reasons that people drink non-alcoholic beer is that they don't have to explain themselves when they go into a pub or a party situation. You had a guest, young lady, on your show in the past month or so who gave up alcohol. She said, alcohol is not your friend. I took this on board and gave up alcohol for January, at least. So far, so good. That was Claire. And you can listen back. Claire Fulham, wasn't it? Claire Fulham also goes under the moniker of Claire Balding. And she was very strong on it. She's a young mother who spoke about her experience of giving up alcohol. And if you Google Claire Fulham, you'll get that as a podcast. Now, Anish Toshi now the Prescalton and Oakdale Cotta Wallish. Gurumaga Coit, thank you very much. Ray, when I drive through the Gap of Dunlow in Kerry, I always play The Lonesome Boatman, says Tom.
She makes this.
Oh, that's Paul Mescal. Good luck, Paul. Here he is. Yeah, I can see it. I'm there with you, Tom. There's an idea now for Discover Ireland. So when you're coming into an area, they have a suggested Spotify playlist that captures the mood of the area. That's not a bad idea at all. Get Paul Kelly on the line. Is that his name? He's the head of Port Fodge. His name is Kelly. Maybe his name isn't Paul. Anyway, Who Done It is our quiz, and we've two people standing by. Yeah, two people standing by, ready to answer three questions each. Whodunits, and there will be clues, and there is a prize. And it's two nights stay for two people in the iconic K Club. And it's a culinary escape. And you've breakfast and brunch and dinner in the Barton, the clubhouse, and then the Palmer. And they've loads of things to do down there. They've 7 different food and drink spaces in one place. www.kclub.ie. You always know when the presenter is losing it when they say the www bits. kclub.ie, kclub.ie. Hello, Devon. How are you?
Hello, Ray. How are you? Very well, thanks.
You wouldn't have to go far if you were going to, because you're in Maynooth.
Wouldn't have to go far, no. So, right. Yeah, just down the road.
Are you named after Devon in England?
I'm not, actually. I was saying to one of your colleagues, my mum played basketball for Ireland. She's at a competition somewhere in the world, heard the name, and you remarked to whether I was a boy or a girl, I was going to be Devon. So, right. Not after England.
So she played for the Irish team?
She did, yeah. She was very good as well.
Yeah. Are you tall?
I am, yeah.
Yeah.
I play too, but I was saying earlier on, much less glamorous, I play for Nace.
That's nice, yeah. And what do you do?
I am a speech and language therapist.
Right, whereabouts?
So, Nace. It's all about Nace, yeah. right. But living in Maynooth, so I practice from Nace, but we're actually nationwide, so it's a residential service.
Right. And Nace won something in the Tidy Towns this year, did they? Didn't they?
You're telling me now, I'm not entirely sure. No, yeah. I know if it was Maynooth.
You know it was Maynooth, yeah, because that's your home place. Yeah. So you travel into Nace. That's not much.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, how long does that take you?
Only about 20 minutes if I leave it at the right time. So, yeah, I've been down to a fine art, so I do. So the working from home days help as well, so it takes the sting out of it.
I'm a bit jealous of you because you haven't seen any of the Oscar-nominated movies. So you've treats in store for you there.
I do. I was saying my boyfriend hasn't got a great attention span, so I'm trying to nail him down to be able to sit and watch with me. So maybe this weekend.
Well, what would you say now is attention span? Could it go beyond 3 minutes?
if the phone is in his hand, no.
Right, we leave that there. Okay, you're up against John Judd, who's in Rolestown in Dublin. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing fine, Ray. And yourself?
Good. Where's Rolestown?
It's between Swords and Ashbourne.
Ah, right. Okay, yeah. North County Dublin.
It's between Swords. It's about midpoint between Swords and Ashbourne.
Yeah, and would you say you're rural?
Yeah. It's very rural. There's golf courses and horse studs around the place.
Nice. Yeah, but we're still close to the city. The best of both
only
worlds.
Only 13 miles from O'Connell Street, actually.
Oh, yeah. And you're making a big pot of soup.
Well, I was, yeah. That's done and dusted.
Right. So what sort of soup is it?
Packet soup. Your researcher asked me what I was putting into it, and I said water.
Yeah. I was going to say to you, do you start off with onions and potatoes and a bit of butter?
This was ready, steady, cook. Two packets in a big pot.
Yeah, great.
Keep lashing the water until you get to the thickness you want, and that's it.
That's it. You're married to Noelle.
Correct, yeah.
Yes, how long?
35 years. Yeah, 35 years, yeah.
And were there children involved?
Three boys. Well, they're men now, actually. Yeah, three men.
Yeah, and are they around or gone?
Two of them are here, and the other one is, I think, he's not too far away, anyway.
Right, yeah. And is that Noelle there? Hi, Noelle.
Hello, Ray.
Yeah, are you on the other line or just beside him or what?
I'm on the other line.
All right, remember you used to do that as kids. Well, we didn't have two phones, but some of my mates used to do it. They'd listen in on their parents' conversations. Okay, so it's John and Noel up against Devon. Sorry about that. There's a bit of a numerical advantage there, Devon. So you know the deal. Three questions. I will tell you the category first. Then you will decide if you want to go for a clue or not. If you do go for a clue, you get 1 point. Without a clue, you get two if you get it right. And then whoever gets the most at the end is today's winner. And if it's drawing points, we go to a tie-break question. Good luck to all three of you. Here we go. Now, Devon, we are starting with music. So do you want a clue or not?
We will go for no clue.
No clue. Okay. Who is this? You gotta roll with it. You gotta take it time. You gotta say what you say. Don't let anybody get in your way. There's a song too much for me to take. Don't ever stand aside. Don't ever be denied. You wanna be who you be if you're coming with me. Who's that? I need an answer now. No.
Oasis?
Yeah, need them quicker the next time, but yeah, Oasis, I'll give it to you. And I'll give John and Noel the same leniency as well. But 2 points for you. Well done, Devon. John and Noel, do you want a clue or not?
Yeah, no clue. We'll have to.
Okay. Music again. Who is this? Who's that?
Would it be Monte Hoople?
No. It's Blur. Monte Hoople. All the young dudes and Monte Hoople. So no points Judd. Okay. Devon, to you then. Second question's on history.
Do you want to? No clue again.
No clue. And I need your answer as quickly as you can after the clip, please. So who is this?
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals.
Who's that?
It's Donald Trump.
It is Donald Trump. Another 2 points to you. Thanks, Mr. Claxon. John. History for you as well.
Yeah, no clue.
No clue, okay. Who is this, John?
So let me say that very clearly. It is not for anybody else to lecture the British people as to the decision they must make. It's our duty to inform.
Yes, it is. So
that
you don't want to hear the rest of it. Fair enough, okay.
Yeah.
Right, so that's 2 points. Well done, you're on the scoreboard, John and Noel. Devon, you're on 4, John's on 2. So if you get anything from this one, you are today's winner. So with that in mind, and me telling you that the category is film, do you want a clue or not?
Yeah, I'll take a clue, please, this time.
Okay. This actor has played the role of Buddy the Elf. Here we go.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight. Off the coast of Tampa Bay yesterday, one lucky cameraman happened to catch an unusual aquatic daredevil. His name is Nutty the Squirrel, and he's 3 years old. How about that? That squirrel can water ski.
Yeah.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
You say I think the answer is Will Ferrell.
It is Will Ferrell as Ron Burgundy there. You get a point for that. Brings you up to 5. John, you can't catch her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I realize that.
It was Motta Hoople that caught you out there, Blur. We're going to send you out, because Noel was there on the line, we're going to send you out two Ray D'Arcy Show key cups to put your soup in when you're going on a picnic or a walk. And lovely talking to you, John, out in Rolltown.
All right, okay, Ray.
Enjoy the rest of your evening. Thanks, John.
All right,
see
thanks
you. Bye. Devon, well done.
Woohoo! Thank you very much.
You're making the long trip.
I was a bit cheeky with the clue there in the last one, but if we were home and hosed, I needed it.
I know, there's a bit of strategy involved. So yeah, you may not have got it if you didn't get the clue. Okay, you were making the long trip from Maynooth to the K Club, and you can see what's in store for you at kclub.ie. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Have a nice
much.
Evening. Bye now. Delighted see you, Devon. Next. Bye.
Cheers,
bye.
Thanks,
Ray.
Bye.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Samantha Rawson, certified canine behaviour and training consultant, also known as a dog expert, will be with us in a moment. So if you have any questions for her about anxious dogs, get them into us now, ray@rte.ie or 51551. Hosier, his version of Led Zeppelin's Whole Lot of Love. Mick's been on from Dublin 16. He says, when the kids were young, going for a drive, I used to play Woody Guthrie's Car Song. Let's have a listen to that, see how that works.
Take me riding in the car, take me riding in the car. Take you riding in my car, I'll take you riding in my car.
Fond memories.
Fond memories, Mick.
Now, Samantha Rawson, our dog expert, joins us in studio. Good to see you. Long time no see.
You too, Ray. Yeah, it's a long time since we actually met in person.
Yes, yeah, with COVID and everything else. Yeah. So good. And we've loads to get through here.
Great, great.
We tried to sort of maybe focus people's attention on nervous dogs.
Yeah.
So we got loads of them in. So let's get straight to it. Hello, Samantha. Recently got a Whippet pup. Very nervous dog. Now 5 months old. My issue is with walking her. I walk her every day since I got her. Since she was 13 weeks old. Still, though, as recent as last night, she will dig her feet in and refuse to walk. She doesn't mind the collar or lead. It seems to be outside. But as soon as we are on the way back from the walk, she pulls and pulls as if she can't wait to get home. I've kept dogs my whole life, and this is my first Whippet. And I've read that they are naturally a timid dog, but she's great other than that. Any of my other dogs love walking at that stage, and I try to make it as fun as possible so she will associate the walk with fun, but it's not working at all. I'm at a loss. Help. Thanks.
Okay. So the key is in there somewhere. If you read that again, she pulls when she is on her way back from the walk and wants to get home. So she's telling you that she feels safer heading towards safety than away from it. So the key to a dog that is worried about the outside world, especially walking, and especially puppies, anybody has a puppy out there, this is really important. You carry the dog away from safety and you walk it back to safety. Now, this dog obviously is a bit old to be carried. So if she could drive it somewhere, maybe somewhere safe, so somewhere not near the road, maybe get out and walk a couple of steps and let the dog walk back to the car. Okay, so it's all about the dog's focus is heading towards safety, that it's not being overwhelmed with the world in its face. So when you take it out of the house, it's suddenly in the world and now it's completely overwhelmed and panicked. So the key is always to get the dog back to safety so it knows where it's going, and yet then all this peripheral information is not as magnified.
So hold on. So you carry it somewhere and let it walk back, for example.
If it's a puppy.
But you don't do that forever.
No, you don't do it forever. It's to say to the dog, I will always bring you back to safety, so that the dog doesn't break its trust in you. Because if you, the owner, put it in a situation that it's terrified in, it then looks at you and says, what are you doing to me?
Uh-huh.
So it's about building that relationship that the owner will never put it in a place of danger. The owner is always the anchor for safety.
So it's about trust.
All of these cases are about trust.
Okay. So as you say, this particular dog is probably too big, old to be carried. So what do you suggest? It's the car, is it?
It's the car. If you can drive her somewhere and somewhere nice and quiet, because it might be the traffic. It could be, I don't know where this lady lives, but it could be an urban area and she's worried about the traffic and all the noises. So if you can drive her somewhere to a park or you know, I used to drive down to the Nace racecourse, believe it or not, or even to the Phoenix Park or somewhere, bring her out of the car and then get her to walk back like 10 feet. So she succeeds really quickly. So a couple of feet in your home. And then you build it up and build it up and build
trust,
it up.
Trust. Yeah. Okay, good luck with that. Nervous barking rescue collie is the heading for the next one. Hello, Samantha. I have a 3-year-old collie. She was a rescue and came into my home at 2 months. She is so nervous around dogs and humans, she barks her head off. And while out walking, if a dog approaches, she reacts. If someone comes into the house, she barks initially but calms down when she is comfortable with that person. Any tips would be very much appreciated. Anne.
Okay, and so it's about safety and distance and time. So if you have anywhere in the house where you can put up a baby gate, or if you can't do that, maybe go out and buy a puppy pen or get somebody to make you some kind of pen so that she is behind a gate, so she has somewhere to retreat to when somebody comes into the house. So again, you say in your message that she loses the plot when somebody comes into the house. So she wants to get away. She's feeling encroached upon. So think about people coming into your house as if there was a burglar coming into your home. You know, every person to a dog is a burglar. They don't know them. What are they doing in my house? So it's always about giving the dog the option to move away and to maybe go to its bed. And then it can observe the intruder or the stranger at a distance. It's always about putting in a distance that the dog can view the world from a safe distance.
Are dogs aware of our relationships with other humans?
Yeah. Right. So we're role models. So if the dog sees us being friendly towards the person, they will then see, oh, you're okay with that person. But the dog can't do that if it's sitting right beside you because it's feeling overwhelmed. So a bit like going to a party, you might sit in the corner and watch everybody for the first 20 minutes and then you might loosen up. So dogs need exactly the same time.
Good luck with that, Anne. Samantha, I have a lovely golden lab. She's now three. We got her as a pup. COVID came and she didn't see anyone calling to the house, and now she doesn't like people calling. She barks and runs at them to jump up aggressively. People are afraid of her. She's okay if they're in the house before her, but once they come in the door on top of her, she loses the head.
Okay.
So this is similar. I don't know how to get her used to visitors calling. She's the most lovable dog to us and is a big pup, really. Any help appreciated.
Okay, so it's very similar to the last one. So it's about putting in distance. But also, it's really important that the owner doesn't allow the dog to run and bark and jump on people, because the dog could be intimidating the person that comes into the house. So that's not really fair on your visitor.
Mm.
It's also not good for the dog because it's practicing very, very bad, unacceptable behaviour. So don't allow it to happen. So the similar advice in the previous one is the same. Put up a barrier, give the dog somewhere to go. But really important with this dog, do not allow it to practice bad behaviour.
So how do you stop it?
Well, again, put it in another room or put it outside.
Yes.
You know.
So if the doorbell rings,
put the dog out first before
that's your
you
first
open the door.
Job. Yeah. That's your first job.
Yeah.
That's important, isn't
it? It's really important because dogs are learning all the time and it's up to us to supervise them.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Samantha, we have an 11-month-old cockapoo who's very nervous around traffic. We can't walk her along a main road. If we do try, she pulls like mad and weaves around, turns to look at the cars coming behind us and just desperately wants to get away. We've tried to get her used to the road by taking her very short walks along the path next to the road, but it's very stressful for her and for us. She's also a bit of a reluctant walker anyway, in particular when leaving our house. She's fine going to the beach or park. Any advice would be appreciated. As we don't like to see her so stressed and we live in an urban area, so we are limited as to where we can go with her at the moment. Liz.
Okay, so what I find fascinating about these cases, Ray, is the key is always in there. The owner has actually given themselves the answer, because this dog likes to go to the beach or the park. So that dog is telling you, I like quiet, open spaces. I don't open areas. So again, you know, and she says she lives in an urban area. So the dog doesn't want to be taken out of the house and put on a lead and walk down the road. There's nothing in the rule book that says you have to stick a lead on your dog and walk it down the road. Nothing.
Right.
You can put it in a car and drive it to the beach. Put it in a car and drive it to a field. You know, people are obsessed with sticking their dogs on leads and bringing them down the road. So I live in the country, obviously, you'd know that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's fine for you to say that.
But it's really about, again, giving her the time. So maybe go outside the house and just sit there on the wall and let her watch the world. Don't ask her to walk, just let her watch.
From your experience, are dogs born nervous?
They can be.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can be. They can certainly be born nervous or born a bit worried. But usually what I see is people, in their effort to socialise them, overwhelm them. They bring them out far too soon and they bring them to the wrong place, because everybody has been, you know, told you must socialise your dog. You don't need to socialise your dog if it's already nervous. If it's already nervous, all you're going to do is make it worse. So bring it to a quiet area. Do not bring a nervous dog to a busy area. Think about the analogy of the party. Think about the introvert that's dragged up to dance at the party. That's what you're doing to your dog.
Yeah.
Okay. So
it's not going to end well.
No.
Okay. David says, I have a miniature Jack Russell with barrier aggression.
Now, I don't know what David means by barrier aggression.
What is barrier aggression? I mean, looking for strategies.
If you can qualify what barrier aggression means, it could be frustration. Jack Russells are very wound up little guys and they don't take frustration easily. So if they see something that they can't get to, they tend to lose the plot, and which is made worse behind a barrier. So I would probably suggest take down the barrier and maybe put the dog on a long line, not a short lead, because that's the same as a barrier. Put him on a long line and give him the distance to see what he wants to see, but that he can't get to it. It sounds like if it's a Jack Russell, that's frustration.
This is an explanation here. A dog's territorial behaviour when placed behind a barricade, such as a gate, screen or fence. You were right. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, frustration.
So a long line.
A long line instead of a barrier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck, David, with your barrier aggressive Jack Russell. Rodney is a boxer pup, 18 weeks old. I look after Rodney 2 days a week. When my son brings Rodney in the car, he suffers from travel sickness. My son has put Rodney into the car to get him used to the car and not drive the car, in order to get Rodney used to the car. If you understand, we've stopped feeding Rodney for an hour or two before Rodney goes in the car. Has your dog expert, Samantha, any advice, please, for Rodney? How many times did I say Rodney there?
Okay, Rodney. Get the dog used to the car being his bed. So put his bed in the car.
Really?
Yeah, make the car his bed. Put him in the car with his bed, with maybe a little toy or something while you're washing the kitchen floor. Put him in the car as often as you can without the car ever moving, so he is perfectly happy to sleep in the car. Only when he's happy to sleep in the car do you move the car. what's happening is everything is happening far too quickly for that particular dog. And actually not feeding him for 2 hours is not enough. Because if you know you're going to go in the car, I probably wouldn't feed him brekkie. Let his mum give him lunch or brekkie or whatever. He's only going to his mum to be babysat, so
yeah,
he doesn't need brekkie. You know,
yes, yeah, so don't feed him at all that day.
So don't feed him at all, but get him used to the car being his bed. And, and you know, give him his own scent and make him all snuggy buggy.
Right.
And when he gets used to that, then maybe reverse down the driveway and back again.
Okay. I hope it works out for Rodney. Samantha, I have a dog. She's 7 years old now. I have her since she was 12 weeks old. She's terrified of men.
Mm.
I have one male friend who she would see often and she loves him. How can I help her? Thanks, Carol.
If she likes food or if she likes toys, toys are better than food in this scenario. Try and get her to play with your male friend with toys, and then maybe bring another male friend and play, you know, what's that kid's name? Pass the donkey, you know, where you just throw the toy from one to the other. And get her to kind of see somebody else having a bit of crack with the toy. And then when she's kind of not being nervous, throw her the toy.
And they can they know the difference between a man and a woman.
They do, yeah.
Is it smell or?
Well, it's energy.
Right.
So, you know, we have different hormones. We behave differently.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's how I said smell. Yeah.
Well, it's more than smell now, right?
I'm just saying for dogs, Samantha, for dogs. I'm trying to get inside the head of a dog.
Okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah, okay. Right, Samantha, you will be back. Thanks for that. And
hopefully
we've helped some owners of nervous dogs this time round. Now, that's it from us. Thanks, Samantha. Thank you very much. Cormac and Sarah are on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.